KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I thank you for joining me today on the show. Today, we are actually doing a live interview. I have another brave guest who decided that we could do live radio, and so I'm excited to have this guest in today. It's Professor Michael Shanks of Stanford University, who is heading up a number of fascinating projects all dealing with archaeology and technology. And I'm going to let Michael in detail discuss the Metamedia Lab, the Presence Project, and other really cutting-edge and exciting projects that he's heading up along with others at Stanford, dealing with the question of virtual worlds and how virtual worlds can be used and virtual technology can be used to not only deal with questions of archaeology, but deal with questions of storing and replicating and allowing for access to our history, both present and future, as well as questions of what it is to be in the world, the technological world today, and particularly virtual worlds. What do we mean by presence? What do we mean by identity? It's work that is both on one level abstract, but on another level very, very practical, because what we're dealing with here is an extension of the larger questions involving access to information. And information itself is ultimately what most people are attempting to derive and attempting to access when they turn on their computers, when they access the internet. And in Michael's work, we find a lot of very cutting edge questions about what it means to do that with today's technology. To quote him, and I'm quoting him even though he's here, but he has a website, archaeographer.stanford.edu, where he says, "For me, archaeologists do not discover the past. They work on what remains. Archaeology is about our relationships with what is left of the past." And then he closes with the phrase, "We are all archaeologists now." Well, I'm curious to find out how it is that we are all archaeologists and what it is that Michael is doing in this space. And so I'm very excited to have him here today. For those of you listening live on KZSU right now, you are hearing music that will, in one way or another, touch on buildings or just generally jazz. Right there, you heard an architect's song by Kate Bush. We're going to take another short music break. And when we come back, another song involving buildings. We'll start the conversation with Professor Michael Shanks of Stanford University here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. On the other side of the glass is someone that I'm very excited to have here. Michael, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
It's great to be here, David.
Let's start right off with what I ask a lot of guests, and I think it's helpful here. What is your background, and how did you become interested in these issues?
I'm an archaeologist, and I've been an archaeologist of sorts for as long as I can remember, to be honest. It was a schoolboy interest. I was digging up in the north of England on Hadrian's Wall back in the mid-70s. Went to college, did archaeology and anthropology at Cambridge. Decided that that was not for me. So I turned to classics. I'd had a very traditional classics education, Latin, Greek, ancient history, and very, very much on the languages, I have to say. But anyway, that was the way it was then. And but loved the stuff, the material, and decided to return to those classics roots, having done archaeology and anthropology, as I say. And so took to Greek archaeology, the archaeology of Greece, and spent, on the way, 10 years researching Corinthian perfume jars, little things produced in Corinth in the middle of the first millennium BCE.
And from Corinthian perfume jars,
yep,
we reach the Metamedia Lab and Presence Project.
Yes.
So you have to help me out with where it is that you turned in that direction.
Okay. It's really actually straightforward. It sounds bizarre, but it's not. Okay, yeah, archaeologists are interested in stuff from the past, things that have been made by people, used by people, where people live. But there's an emphasis here on the materiality of things. So there's one connection straight away, materiality. So studying pottery, how it's made, manufacture, but an overarching theme of design. And, of course, design can be applied not just to material goods, but to non-material, immaterial things, too. So archaeologists, at least the way I look at it, are, in a very strong sense, historians of design. We are interested in how people have got on with stuff over the millennia, well, for as long as we've been human, really. The other side of it, I'll pick up that issue of material stuff in a minute. The other side of the connection that you're probing, David, is media. Well, how do we get to that? Right, archaeologists deal in stuff. We have to turn the things we are interested in, the sites we dig up, the landscapes we explore, we have to turn them into something else. That is, the material has to become a text, a plan, an architectural plan, an elevation, a drawing, a photograph, a video, a database. It's a process of transformation, of turning things into media. We write about stuff, and you can't do it any other way. We have to be intimately concerned with how we turn things into, as I say, media. So media are at the core of archaeology. It's just not often acknowledged that it's as serious an issue as it is. So my lab, of late I've spent a lot of time developing what is called the Metamedia Lab in Stanford's brand new gorgeous archaeology center.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's not brand new, it's in an old building, but that's right, isn't it? It should be. We've got a new archaeology center at Stanford, and my Metamedia Lab in there focuses on issues of media. How archaeologists write about the past, picture the past, turn it into, as I've described, these media forms. But it's a metamedia lab. Now, that's crucial. Mm-hmm. The reason it's a metamedia lab is that the lab is not in the business of training students how to draw pictures or how to take photographs. The lab is in the business of saying, if you want to take a photograph, how might you do it?
Hmm.
So it's not a training lab. It's asking the meta-level questions of what lies behind working on what is left of the past. Because you introduced me with the right kind of words, David.
Thanks.
The Metamedia Lab has a broader brief than just simply attending to the needs of archaeologists. Our argument is that for at least 250 years, for as long as really we've been in the modern Western world, anyway, at least, for the last couple of hundred years, people have been concerned with the past in very particular ways. We've been interested, for these 200 years, people have been interested in ruin, in what becomes of the past, in the relationship of places to pasts, things happened here and leave traces. And we visit them now as tourists. You know, 65% of tourism, which is arguably one of the biggest economic sectors in the world today, 65% of tourism is cultural tourism.
Hmm.
And it's hard to tell the statistics, but well over half of that cultural tourism has an archaeological component. We are fascinated by visiting the past as almost a kind of foreign country, as is sometimes said. So anyway, we're all archaeologists now under this argument, as you pointed out, working on the remains of the past. That puts archaeology really at the fore, right at the center of a whole series of things to do with history, genealogy, family history, belonging, roots, who you are, depending upon, you know, what family you have or what happened in the particular part of the world and how you're connected to it, history. We're all, as I say, involved with these memory practices, these this work that gets done on what's left of the past.
We, you know, the popular vision, the popular culture vision of the archaeologist is the Indiana Jones type character going into the crevices of the earth, dusting off something, finding a piece of the past. And when we look at the way information is stored today, information and indeed our history is being stored in ways obviously that didn't exist 10 years ago, which didn't exist 30 years ago. And of course, when you go back to the Corinthian perfume jars, it's a whole different sphere. How does the archaeological method, the method in which you were trained, apply to the kind of virtual worlds and the technology that exists today?
Well, start with the straightforward stuff. We're now surrounded by a bunch of really very creative software technologies that enable, you know, a lot of us to very simply deal with collections of photos, your music collection, how it's mobilized with, you know, iTunes and your MP3 player, your personal memories in photos, how you organize them in albums, but then how you share them online with, you know, systems like Flickr, where, you know, you're uploading stuff for other people to see, to engage with, maybe even to tag or comment upon. These are new kinds of, well, let's call them memory practices. Mm-hmm. You know, you're dealing in stuff, photos, for example. You're dealing in things that are traces of your past, and you're mobilizing them, you're working on them in these new digital ways. But they're new digital ways that are nevertheless in continuity. They share so much with, you know, what we've always done as people with memories. You're working on them, you're mobilizing them in the present, you're telling stories with bits of the past, with memories, with artifacts, with imagery, with sound, with music. In terms of the archaeology, there is a continuity here from digital through analog and vice versa. Then you get into very specific questions as to how archaeologists deal with this. Well, we have, you know, methods, technologies, techniques that have been developed over, you know, these two centuries since the, you know, really inauguration of the discipline. Back, yeah, it's kind of mid-19th century, actually. But anyway, you know, we've developed a bunch of technologies for how you build up folders, dossiers, crime scene reports, actually, forensics, of course. Hmm. And indeed, in the popular imagination, forensics, detective work, shares a great deal with archaeology and shares a great deal of methodology with archaeology.
The history aspect of it, before we delve into some of the specifics of what you're doing here at Stanford, is one that I'm personally interested in as an amateur historian, and indeed looking at the history of science is something that I've tried to do on Hearsay Culture with guests like Ann Finkbeiner, who wrote about the Jasons and others, and Eric Davis, who's been on, who talks about the mysticism involved with technology, which ties into some of the work that I think you're doing. You, on your blog, the most recent entry you had, linked to a website that has sought to develop film that, at least from what I understood from what I read, and you can clarify it, but basically finds old cameras with film that has been exposed but not developed and develops the film.
Yeah.
And in that, it's a form of archaeology, is it not? But it's using technology where now you have pictures, which obviously were forgotten for one reason or another, being not only developed but placed on the internet for anyone to consume. In how does that idea, which you link to on your blog, tie into what you're trying to do here at Stanford?
It's, you know, traces of the past, neglected traces. Archaeologists notoriously, you know, they delve into the garbage heaps of history. You know, it's the kind of everyday detritus of life that archaeologists usually focus on. Although, of course, the Indiana Jones vision is one of treasure and all the rest. Well,
right.
You know, on a lucky day, on a good day. But most of the time, it's really rather mundane. But those traces of everyday life can be utterly fascinating. I mean, you know, the contemporary arts have developed a whole field here of focus upon found objects, you know, and finding something. That little moment of discovery of something incidental, something overlooked, is a tremendously, sometimes, powerful moment. And it is an archaeological moment, too. It's part of this, it's part of that sentiment, if you like, or those that bunch of sentiments that make us all archaeologists now. It's this fascination, those little bits left over. Now, here, with this particular, it's a guy on the internet, as I say, who publicizes his fascination with old cameras that have undeveloped film in them.
Uh-huh.
And, He seems to have a lot of cameras, though, I have to say.
Yeah, well, I was wondering where he got
like,
some of those.
He's got a very impressive collection. So maybe, but you know what? Maybe he's making it up a bit as well. You know, at least he's exploring this fascination.
Right.
Anyway, but then, as I say, this kind of, the ephemerality of some of these images, are just the mystery of these images, because, you know, they're just people's snapshots, now developed, and then put together in a collection. Which is bizarre, if you think about it. Why you would take all these, you know, utterly unconnected, disparate bits of people's lives, forgotten, neglected, no, don't even matter anymore, and then make something of them to make, and then there's stories in there, everyday stories. You know, it's all it is, I think, quite fascinating.
And it's something that, again, I mean, one could find these old cameras and develop them and attempt to, you know, before the internet, find an art gallery or photography gallery to put. I mean, the dissemination of the information, I guess, is what ties me into kind of asking a broad question of getting down to brass tacks and what you do here at Stanford. You are the head, and perhaps you could describe it better than me, but you're head of the Stanford Humanities Lab. What is that, and under its rubric, what falls?
I've got this lab, which is part of the Archaeology Center, Metamedia. Metamedia's received funding in the past from Stanford Humanities Lab. And then my connection with them grew and such that I'm now with Henry Lowood and Jeffrey Sharp directing the outfit. Okay, Stanford Humanities Lab. It sounds like a bit of an oxymoron. You know, lab and humanities, how do they go together?
Right.
Well, actually, it's quite simple. What we do is we run... it's project-based. So we run projects that cut across disciplines in the humanities that often involve a technology component, particularly new media technologies. Why? Well, we're not technology-led, no. We're interested in exploring usually the themes or topics that don't fit into conventional disciplines. We're interested in exploring them in teams. We're interested in experimental research and development, hence the lab thing. We're interested in output that isn't usually the conventional academic output. So we're interested in making stuff that isn't necessarily a book or, you know, a paper or a lecture course or whatever, although we do those too. Mm-hmm. Some of the things we've done include investigating the history of gaming. The lab has run a project for a good number of years, looking at gaming technologies, history, and you probably don't know that, well, you might know, I don't know, that Stanford has the biggest collection of video and computer games in the world.
One of the toughest reasons for leaving is I have a Commodore 64 in my office that I use for games, and it pales by comparison to what's here.
Now, there's media archaeology for you.
Exactly.
Because, you know, the way technology is so rapidly now going defunct, you know, obliges us in many ways to look to the future and what we're going to do with these.
Right.
Whether it's literally keep your Commodore 64 or whether it's provide a virtual Commodore 64. So the issue of virtual machines takes us into some interesting futures for these archaeological questions. How are you going to work on the remains of the world of Commodore 64 in 50 years' time?
Yeah.
Is it going to be at all even possible?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a question of the archaeology of the future, but it is also precisely one of media archaeology, mediation, you know, how you connect with stuff like this that is in 50 years' time, from the past.
Right.
And what you do with it, how you work on it, to make it into your present and indeed your future.
The interdisciplinary aspect of this is also interesting, and I think it kind of gives me a good opportunity to ask you, who are involved in terms of the disciplines? That when you talk about something like archaeology in technology, to put it broadly, you're crossing a whole wide range of areas, and indeed it goes into areas of law when you deal with copyright. Right, and preservation there.
Yeah.
So for the benefit of listeners, an idea of the interdisciplinary nature of the work you're doing.
Yeah. Well, if I just put to one side the humanities lab, let's stick with the archaeology because it's more direct. Archaeology has always been a bridging field. It bridges different areas. Just think about it. In fact, you know, archaeology is, you know, dealing with the whole history of humanity from, you know, as long as we've been human, which includes, you know, issues of genetics, evolution, evolutionary biology, social change, cultural change, you know, sometimes not so subtly distinct from social change, how things change, early civilization, agriculture, human relationships with other species, subsistence practices, economics, political economy, and then art history and all the kind of, you know, more humanities-oriented aspects of human experience. And at the heart of it, you know, design history is one aspect of it, how people have made different kinds of stuff throughout history. Relationships with place and space, how people have lived in certain environments and other environments in different ways. And collection, how at the heart of so many different endeavors, disciplinary endeavors today, is, you know, databasing, collecting stuff, managing it, working upon it in different ways, building up data banks and turning them into information, which gives you traction on key questions. And I think in an interdisciplinary field such as, you know, archaeology, it's a transdisciplinary field, actually. even post-disciplinary. How about that one? Or non-disciplinary. We've got all these words there.
Wow.
You know, at the moment.
I like non-disciplinary. I'll focus on that one.
Matters of common human concern, you know, where we've come from, what makes us who we are today, whether, you know, the issues facing society today, whether it's digital culture, whether it's, you know, environmental issues, whether it's biotech or whatever, whether these are indeed new issues for humanity, or whether, as I would argue, they've in fact been around in sometimes quite different guise, but sometimes very similar guys. These questions have been around for millennia, actually.
The lab itself, as you mentioned, has MetaMedia as part of it. And I think it leads me to the follow-up question, which is, just to give the broad overview, you have something else called the Presence Project, which is something I mentioned in the intro. And how does that fit into, if I were to put, I don't want to put an org chart together, but if I were, how does the Presence Project, what is it, and how does it fit into MetaMedia and the Humanities Lab?
It's one of these projects, okay? So it's project-based. It's collaborative. It's a team based across Europe and the United States. There are four principal investigators, myself as an archaeologist, two colleagues working in performance, and a computer scientist. Mel Slade is a computer scientist. Nick Kay and Gabriella Yanaki in Exeter, UK, are the performance experts. Okay, so what are we doing? We're looking at a theme that I think, in terms of digital culture, in terms of media, is at the heart of many, many questions, concerns today, and that is presence. Now, what's presence? It's about relationships in media between live and recorded. What's the difference? How do you sustain a sense of being there? It's the presence of the past, which, of course, is, again, part of this archaeological sensibility I'm claiming we've all got. Right. The remains of the past in the present are the presence of the past. Mm-hmm. And what we do with that, of course, is, you know, well, there are various things to do with it, but it can be very, very powerful as an emotive field, the presence of the past, or the absence of the past. That's the other side of it. Yeah. That things disappear, that things go, can be traumatic, that things are ripped out of context, whether it's directly in archaeology, the destruction of the past can be profoundly traumatic in both an individual sense and a collective community sense. So the presence, absence of the past is one of our themes. Now, the full title of the project is Performing Presence from the Live to the Simulated. We're interested in investigating questions such as, you know, what makes a memory come alive? What constitutes an effective live recording of an event? What comes after the event? How do you document social experience? That is, how do you, you know, give an extended presence to an event that stops? You know, how do you keep it going?
Right.
All of these questions we're exploring with a host of performance artists. My angle on this is that contemporary art, and it can look very esoteric and very, very difficult. But anyway, if you do engage with contemporary art, the fine arts I'm talking about, performance art, conceptual art, installation art, net art, art, wacky stuff on the web, if you engage with it appropriately, I think what you're looking at, for me, is almost a research lab of questions about culture today. You know, and I don't think that, you know, you can see that in music, you can see it in lots of different fields. I think it'll be widely accepted. Okay, so if the contemporary arts present us with a kind of research lab, let's get involved and see what we can learn from artistic practices with, you know, that has a bearing on these questions. Now, a lot of contemporary art is very savvy about using media. About how it records, makes use of recordings, how it makes use of imagery. It's often very self-reflexive. The use of video, for example, very smart, clever, you know, manipulation of different media. So we're tracking with the likes of Gary Hill, who's a video artist in the United States, with Lynn Hirschman, who is one of the foremost, if not the foremost, artist working in new media today. She's based in San Francisco. We're working with Tony Ursula in New York, Builders Association in New York, mixed reality gaming company, Blast Theory, are another one of our bunch, and a whole load of others who really deserve mention, but I'm not going to say it because we don't have time.
Right.
What we're doing is we're tracking their work. We're running workshops with them. We're deeply investigating their work, sharing in this project collaboration. We're sharing stuff with them in order to get a handle on these questions. It also includes direct simulation, modeling of some of the techniques that, for example, a performance artist might use to engage with an audience. So performers have all sorts of devices for engaging with their audiences. What we're doing is modeling some of these techniques in a fully immersive virtual environment, virtual reality. This is it's a cave. I'm hesitating because I can never remember what the acronym stands for. cave will do. It's Plato's cave, for goodness sake. A cave is a 3D computer environment. We have use of Mel Slater's cave at University College London. And right at this moment, my colleague Nick Kay is busy setting up avatars, performers in the cave, and seeing how people get on with these virtual humans, how they react to them and such.
It sounds like, to me, ultimately, where the technology intersection is I think the most challenging for someone that isn't immersed in it, is how one interacts with the worlds that you're describing. And I think in that way, I think we'll take a short music break here. When I come back, I kind of want to take a step back for a moment and then drill down, but focus on the question of how does someone who isn't immersed in technology, who isn't as familiar with this, use the kind of applications and the kinds of theories even that you're describing. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU FM Stanford, talking with Professor Michael Shanks of Stanford University. We're going to take a short music break and then continue the conversation. Before we continue the conversation with Professor Shanks, I do want to, as I always do, and I know everyone looks forward to it, this is when I stop the show cold and then ask you for money, which is what everyone loves to hear on the radio. KZSU is a non-commercial, non-profit radio station at Stanford that relies on listeners' donations to continue its wide range of programming. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. We're talking about options here today, ways that we can interact with technology. Well, here's two ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless of what you do, I do hope you keep listening to KZSU. Michael, we're back. And before the break, I was kind of drawing this into the level of the non-technology savvy user. Where does that individual fit into the projects that you're focusing on here at Stanford?
It's very, very directly. Let me give you a scenario. Okay. You're visiting an ancient site. Let's say it's Pompeii, okay? And as part of the experience there, you're offered, you could be, and they're working on this at the moment, actually, a lab in Switzerland, you're offered a visor, a headset. You can stick it on. It's got speakers over your ears, and you've got a big pair of glasses over your eyes that you can see through, so you can see, you can walk around Pompeii, you're going to look at the forum, you look at the theater and such. But the technology enables you at the flick of a switch, and you dial in maybe your precise location, you look at a little sign by the path, and it says, you know, location 28, you dial 28 into the little thing around your belt, and up comes, on your visor, up comes a reconstructed building in the place of what you're looking at. That is, you're looking at the ruin, but the technology builds the past as it was in front of you. Now, question, would that make you feel connected to that place?
Right.
Or what would make you feel that that was real, that it was worth looking at, that it wasn't a gimmick, that it was telling you something? So it's about how do you elicit engagement with places, old places like this. Switch it around from, or switch the scenario from this kind of very famous tourist site, ancient city, of course. Switch it to your own past, your own memories. Family history is a big deal. We are appropriately interested in sharing where we've come from with others and exploring our pasts. What would it mean to be able to take memories, photographs, maybe your own recordings made with older members of your family or younger members of your family, and construct almost museums of your own in a 3D online world, to do, to be able to do easily. So you could create your own collection, your own museum that other people could come and visit. Maybe you could even reconstruct environments, places, spaces, buildings that you grew up in, so that people could revisit those paths. Now, that might seem very personal and maybe even, you know, overindulgent in your memories. But how about this? There's a great deal, of course, of movement of people around the world, and diaspora has been a feature of, you know, our experience for, well, a long time. And it can be, again, as I mentioned earlier, breaking with your past, a traumatic event. Okay, how about an online world as a space where a community in diaspora recreates its own sense of community by creating Is it an artificial reality? Well, there's one of your questions.
Right.
If people can commit to a world full of connections, memories, associations, histories, if that is real, if it makes them feel present in that world, that surely is a fabulous service we can perform to help people regain a sense of who they are now in the present through the presence, effective presence, of the past.
Hmm.
So there is a scenario where technology could help people realize who they are, and it is precisely an archaeological project of working on what's left of the past in the present.
The issues of wearable computing is, I think, fits into all of this presently. And what you're describing in your first hypothetical there is ultimately questions of wearable computing and actually interacting with technology on a bodily level. Is that part of the research or the thinking that you're doing at Metamedia and the
Yes, indeed. We already have it. You know, National Gallery in London, you can rent a little device. It's a headset. Many museums have these, actually, but the National Gallery is a particularly good example.
Mm-hmm.
You can rent a little headset. It has a little pack that goes on your belt. You stop at a painting. There's a tag on the wall. You can dial in the number, and you get a narrative story, a guide, a commentary upon the painting you're looking at. Right, okay, take that to located medium, right? Okay, you're located in the gallery looking at a particular picture. Take it out into the field. Imagine where you have a device which knows where you are through GPS, through a satellite location. It knows where you are. You can maybe have a screen with you or some device for interacting with information, with stories and narratives. It knows potentially which direction you're facing in. The technology will easily do this for you now. So you can call up, you can imagine calling up at will, making questions, making queries of the place you are. What happened here? That's profoundly another archaeological sentiment. This happened here.
Hmm.
You know, what is left of what was? What remains of what was? Those are fascinating questions for us. Okay, you're on site, you're looking at a place, and it, the device, could quite easily be used to call up information, plans, maps, images, videos, whatever you want, and give it to you on the spot.
Hmm.
And then you can do the usual stuff that we're very familiar with, follow through those connections to whatever interest you may have. So located media, ubiquitous media, wearable media, you can see how these could work to create, give people a sense of location, and that is often a sense of belonging.
Yeah, and the it does everything you're describing to me is fascinating. As I mentioned before we came on the air, I've been doing just reading through your materials the last couple of days. There's so many things you have going on that I wish I had more time to be involved in. And I guess the issue of time is another one that I want to discuss. I've had a number of guests on the show, including Richard Lanham, who wrote The Economics of Attention, and others that focus on the information basically, the flow of information being so enormous that human beings in one way or another are either detaching from it because it's too much, or they don't know what to do with it, or they lose any perspective on what's accurate and what isn't. People in the research fields who decry the fact that people do Google searches and just pick the first five sources that they get without regard to their value. All of these questions boil down to questions of access. And what you're talking about with the Metamedia Lab ultimately in a lot of ways has to do with ways for people to relatively easily and in an interactive way filter information. In your view, does the technology exist today to adequately filter information, again, between these two dichotomous groups that I defined, the people who are not technologists and who view the internet as a bit of a mystery, versus the technologists, the people like you and I who engage it and have a, you know, you have a even stronger understanding than I do, but have a basic knowledge at least of what's going on to be able to say this is something useful and this is something that isn't. How does the technology you're dealing with fit into that, and does the technology exist today to grapple with those two very divergent groups of people?
I think I've already mentioned that I'm convinced that a lot of the questions we're facing today are not new.
Mm-hmm.
This business of information overload is, in fact, an old one.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, of course, it takes on particular poignancy and sharpness today with the amount of digital information that's going on. But the management It's not just access, I think, but the management of information has long been an issue in state societies. Back in the Mesopotamian city-state, they found a very effective system, an administrative system, and architecture for dealing with this, which was the storeroom. The storage facility managed using storeroom administrative technologies of record, of logging in and logging out, of writing, of noting, notation, of sealing, of locking up, of pacing up and down, of managing collections, managing storerooms. That, of course, became library science, information science, and such. What I'm saying is that there are systems for management of information, but you know what it also comes down to, and I think this is probably the most direct way into this question, the need for guides. You know, that we can always get lost. You can get lost in the labyrinth of, Mesopotamian palace filled with goods collected from the region and stored there for whatever purpose. You can get lost. Of course we can. What do we do often? We depend upon maps, upon, you know, plans, upon people's experience and sharing that experience through expertise and guides. I believe profoundly in the importance of, providing services, facilities that you can that enable people to be guided through these fields, these spaces. The other thing as well is I think we can teach people to be savvy. And it's an age-old pedagogical issue of, in classics, we call it source criticism. You know, that is the ability to look at a source and scrutinize, criticize, figure out how reliable it is on internal grounds as well as external. You know, so you look at the way it's written, you can figure out whether this is liable to be more or less genuine. So it's kind of, you know, critical faculties of looking at the world around us and assessing whether or not you invest time and energy into it. We're all actually experts at that. But I think we could certainly refine that. So when you come across your Wikipedia article and you're thinking, should I believe this or not? You know, there are on internal grounds, you can look at it and figure out, you know, whether the person who was writing it was really knowledgeable or not. You can tell by the way they write it, the way they quote things, the way they cite other people, the kind of references that they make to the world, the kind of examples they give will show you whether they really understand it or not. So simply on those internal grounds, we can find strategies for dealing with the amount of information that's out there.
In reading through the websites for your various projects, I saw artificial intelligence coming up here or there. And what is the impact of your work on the AI field? How is it that artificial intelligence questions delve or probe the issues that you're working with in MetaMedia?
Let me describe very quickly a project to you that's starting up with a professor emeritus of computer science here at Stanford. Ed Feigenbaum is one of the great figures in AI, artificial intelligence, of the last few decades. Ed is fronting a project to develop something he's calling the Self-Archiving Legacy Toolkit. Ed, like many of us, is concerned with organizing the material of his life, and he's got a tremendous archive of work, of publication, of projects connected directly with himself, with the teams he's led, with the department here at Stanford, all sorts. And in this very interesting field, of course, of important field of AI. Okay, what Ed wants to do is to provide a toolkit that allows you, anyone, to build a body of material that organizes itself, that is smart, that has expert agents, AI agents, little routines, programs, devices, tools that will let you search through that intelligently. So instead of having to carefully organize everything, make sure it's all in the same format, make sure it all fits together, develop a fabulously efficient classification system, develop a smooth, efficient database. Instead of taking that line, he says, look, why can't we just, you know, gather all this stuff up the way it is and then have it almost, well, not almost, but have it as much as we can organize itself and be intelligently queryable. Ooh, that sounded awful. Be in a form where you can make intelligent queries without having to do an enormous amount of work. Right. So using his AI nous, Ed is aiming to build this toolkit that'll help us through this information overload thing. With these augmented forms, this is what I'm really interested in. Yeah. Augmentation, they're kind of like prostheses, you know, bits that we can add on to our memories that'll help us make better memories. Little devices, real or virtual machines, whatever they might be, little devices that help us do this archaeological work that makes us who we are today, working on the remains of the past, whether that's a personal archive, whether it's a collection of family photos, whether it's the collection of poems you've written over the last 50 years, and you want to pull them into an order that isn't going to take the rest of your life, you know,
right.
And perhaps even beyond it. You know what I mean? It's to developing those tools to precisely face this issue of, you know, it's a glorious excess of information. Let's cherish it. Let's not bemoan it. Let's say, look, you know, wow, let's deal with it.
One of the other interesting projects that you're working on, I want to probe a little bit in the remaining 7 or 8 minutes that we have, is the work involving archiving and storing information in its rudimentary sense. And you're working on a project called Project Absentia. And it's a project that I think deals with general issues of archival activity and general issues of how it is that we make sure that data and information that we have remains in a form that we can access. In the broadest question here that I want to probe is really the rudimentary question of how it is that we're storing this technological history. Now, we can talk about, you know, the scanning. I mean, people on a day-to-day basis will take a paper that they have that was created prior to PDF or prior to word processing and scan it as a PDF to store it. But in terms of the question of being able to store what is currently accessible and, in fact, created digitally, what kind of things do you think are happening in that space?
Project Absentia is Tom Mullaney, a history professor here at Stanford. That's his project where he's looking at how things come to get lost. Fascinating question. It's the flip side of presence. Absence,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so that's why Tom and I have ended up in some fascinating conversations just recently. So Tom is getting all that going. What you're probing, though, is a wonderful set of questions that sometimes seem quite dull and boring. You know, library science and archives, oh my goodness, it's dusty, dry, and whatever. Not at all. You know, it is absolutely fundamental to who we are in terms of our personal identity, etc., all these issues we've been talking about. Okay, archaeologists are fascinated by, at the core of their practice is documentation, hence the media thing, making documents. And you're rightly putting your finger on a series of questions that are, you know, very apparent today to do with the future of documentation, the documentation of the present, indeed the past, given digital media. Okay, and I think for some people, you know, it's there is a real vision, a scenario that could work itself out of a digital dark ages. We're all very, very aware of this, I think, of how, you know, old media forms go defunct and you can't access them again. You know, whether it's the old, vinyl records, you know, that you used to have, and, you know, the ease of playing these is becoming, you know, really a specialist issue. Even as we speak, it's been very hard. So whether it's that or, you know, whether it's the CD collection you have and what future it has, and then all the rest, you know, your collection of games for your Commodore 64, you know, wow.
Surprising. After 20 years in my parents' attic.
Does it work?
It actually, 90% of the discs that I have, when I plug them in and put them into the disc drive, after at least 15 years of non-use, loaded right up.
Wow.
To my amazement. Yeah.
Yeah. These questions are fascinating. Anyway, and they're archaeological questions again. Okay, some lines on it, though. What can we say? I think there is an impulse to say, let's find a format. Let's find a robust material form that'll stand the test of time. Mm-hmm. You've perhaps seen, you know, the way Kodak used to market its CDs, photo CDs. It would say, you know, these are gold standard, and literally, you know, used gold as part of the medium to, you know, preserve this magnetic digital information. Well, digital information. So the idea being that, you know, your CDs will last 150 years. Mm-hmm. Well, they might, but is there going to be a CD reader around in 150 years? Right. And then there's the whole thing of quantity as well. You know, is anybody going to be bothered enough to load that CD into the machine? So I think this approach that says let's find a robust format has limitations, serious limits, when it comes to, you know, the fact that you may not be bothered enough, or there may not be the machinery to load up these things, even if they would potentially work. Okay, my line on this, my angle on this argument is that we should think of information, of documents like this, as not for material forms, they are, you know, books, CDs, but really much more they're activities, their processes, they are verbs. Oh. We'll see a lot, you see a lot now in all the hype around Web 2.0 about dynamic documents, you know, about co-authoring documents that don't kind of come to an end. They just keep going. People keep editing them, keep adding to them. They keep growing and eventually they get discarded, but there was never a point where, you know, you had that definitive document.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a lot of interest in this notion of the document as process. And I think that's fundamental because information is a verb. If you want things to last, if you want to look to the future of documentation, you have to find ways where people use it, engage with it, work on it. Hence, archaeologists don't discover the past, static stuff left in the ground. Mm-hmm. It's there, yeah, but what makes it come alive is you work on it. Huh. So you bring it into the present as an active process. Present seen, then, as part of the Presence Project, is precisely focused on this activity, these activities. Okay, so if information is a verb, what we need to do is ensure that people will work on this stuff and manage and engage with stuff in the future. That's the only way it'll stay alive.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of this is, you know, about, again, we know it intimately on a day-to-day level. You know, your floppy disks, 5 1/4 inch, weren't they?
Yeah,
you know, became 3 1/2 inch, became CDs, DVDs, hard drives. You're having to migrate forms.
Yeah.
You have to work on them. You know, your digital photo collection of the kids, you know, will not last unless you keep working on it and, you know, managing it and putting it into new forms and bringing it alive.
Mm-hmm.
So working on the past in this archaeological way is precisely the key to the future of archives in the small sense, personal, but in the big sense of national archives, for example. You can stash them all away in a, you know, air-conditioned, humidity-controlled hole in the ground if you want, but, you know, that'll not guarantee that anybody's going to be interested in them in the future.
On that note, it's sad because an hour show is just never enough, and there's many more follow-ups that I would like to ask. So I invite you back on the show again sometime in the fall or maybe in the spring of next year to continue the conversation. For those people that want to learn more, I know that there's a wealth of websites, but for starters off, for people who want to learn more about the Metamedia Lab generally, where can they go?
There's two quick routes into this. One, you can go to one of my sites is michaelshanks.org. So just go there and you end up into the world. I have to say, mind, it is deliberately very archaeological and labyrinthine. You're going to get lost. But don't worry, that's deliberate. The other quick way through it is to use our fabulous friend Google, which is do a Google search. If you stick, you know, Michael Shanks and then a word after it, it'll turn up something on my website. If it's there, that is, of course.
Perfect. Well, Michael, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture and having this discussion. Like I said, tip of the iceberg, but the work that you're doing is fascinating. It's one of the many reasons why it's very difficult to physically leave Stanford. But I will be virtually involved in Stanford, even though I'll be leaving in a few short weeks. But thank you for joining me today on the show.
Thank you, David. Thanks a lot.
I want to thank Professor Shanks again for being on the show today, discussing a really fascinating area and one that deserves a lot more attention than I can give it in a one-hour show. As I mentioned to Michael, and as I've mentioned on the show the last few weeks, my resident fellow position at Stanford is coming to an end, sadly. But the good news is, directly for people listening to Hearsay Culture and the ones that want to continue listening to it, is that the show will continue to be on KZSU as well as its podcast format. I'm going to become a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society as well as an assistant professor at a new law school school that just opened this past August in Charlotte, North Carolina, called the Charlotte School of Law. And I'm extremely excited to join the faculty ranks and get in the classroom and teach. I view the radio show as an extension of sorts of my my genuine interest and strong interest in teaching and being able to disseminate information in my way, and hopefully other people find it useful and enjoy the process of learning. But what it means for the show really is just that the show will continue. You'll continue to find the show on KZSU as well as through its podcast formats, for those of you that listen to the podcast, on hearsayculture.com or alternatively on the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet and Society, and finally on the CIS webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. So all of those venues will continue to exist. Right now, this week and next week, I'm in the process of recording a number of shows for the summer months while I prepare to teach. I'm going to be focusing on preparing on teaching, but I'm putting together I think will be very interesting and exciting shows for the summer months as well. You can find the schedule for the show by going to hearsayculture.com and clicking on schedule, and you will find all the shows and when they're scheduled to air, so you can continue to listen to the show and find the shows that way. And also, any previous shows can be found by clicking on the listen link as opposed to the schedule link on the Hearsay Culture website. So I want to thank you for listening today. I'd ask you to stay tuned to Hearsay Culture as it goes into its summer months and into the fall, and I'll have more announcements on future guests as I set the schedule up. I'm actually in the process now of getting guests lined up for the fall, so that's been a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to that group of individuals coming on the show. Stay tuned to KZSU for Benji and Trip Over Zero. I am Dave Levine on Hearsay Culture. Thank you for listening today, and I will talk to you next week.